Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 15th February 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to be joined by Vanessa Beely and also Alex Thompson, who'll be reporting from the Netherlands.
Well, we're going to get straight on with this person here, Riam Dalati. As you can see from his Twitter page, he calls himself a BBC Syria producer, esteemed colleague of Mr. Quentin Somerville, BBC Middle East correspondent. Well, he's caused a bit of controversy because he apparently has tweeted this out. After almost 6 months of investigations, I can prove without a doubt that the Douma hospital scene was staged. No fatalities occurred in the hospital. All the white helmets, activists and people I spoke to are either in Idlib or in Euphrates Shield areas. One person was in Damascus, and he followed that up with another tweet which said, in fact, one of the three or four people filming the scene was Dr. Abu Bakr Hanan, a brute and shifty doctor affiliated with Jaish al-Islam. The narrative was that there weren't enough doctors, but here's one filming and not taking part in the rescue efforts. We'll keep the rest for later. Now, this, as many will imagine, has caused quite a furore on Twitter. Well, he has now protected his Twitter feed, and you've got to ask if you could be permitted to follow him at this point. So let me bring Vanessa Beely onto the programme. Welcome to the programme, Vanessa. What are your initial thoughts on this, then?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, he protected his account, I believe, after he previously tweeted out that he was sick to death of activists rearranging bodies during these alleged chemical weapon events. And that was actually very shortly after the alleged Douma attack. He protected his account then because of the flak that he received, and he had to withdraw that tweet and replace it with another one where he didn't put an opinion such as, I'm sick and tired of these activists doing this. So whether he was persuaded to do that by the BBC or not, we don't know. But what is extraordinary is that during the time of the alleged attack on Douma, when I myself was in Damascus, Robert Fisk investigated the attack and basically dismissed it. So did a German journalist who was also on the ground. Riam Dalati kind of joined in the media lynch mob to discredit myself, Eva Bartlett, Robert Fisk, the Syria Working Group that was set up by Professor Piers Robinson. So what is extraordinary is that it's taken him 6 months to arrive at the same conclusion that we all arrived at fairly rapidly after the alleged attack. And why didn't he at least, recommend that we wait for the OPCW investigation prior to the BBC effectively manufacturing consent for the French, UK and US bombing of Syria as a result of the suspicion that the Syrian government had conducted another chemical weapon attack? I say another, according to Western narratives, of course, not according to investigations.
Well, look, let's just remind ourselves of what the scenes were like that were being presented on mainstream media. So pretty brutal treatment of children forcibly having inhalers pushed down their throats effectively here. They're being thrown around, they're being hit on the back and so on. It's a form of child abuse, isn't it? And the key thing is here that once again we had the entire mainstream media getting behind a narrative, a single narrative, and this was used, as you say, to justify the missile attack on Syria. But it wasn't. There was no dissent amongst the mainstream media. They just presented this as what they were told it was.
Absolutely. I mean, I've just been going through all the reports at that time, and basically across the board, so across US media, UK media, including The Guardian, Channel 4, the BBC, they all used these images to present the fact that there had been a chemical weapon attack. Now, what is interesting is, as I said, I was on the ground during this time. I interviewed members of the medical staff, as did Eva Bartlett, as did Robert Fisk, and all of them said to me, actually, this child in the video was being given Ventolin because the majority of these civilians and some children came in with breathing difficulty because of the smoke from the bombing during the military campaign. And so they were not suffering from any sort of chemical weapon inhalation or chlorine or any, they didn't have any symptoms of a chemical attack. And of course, this was completely ignored and discredited by the mainstream media. Now, you know, what is equally extraordinary is now the BBC or a member of the BBC production team is saying categorically that this part of the event was staged. This has to raise the questions as to what other events have been staged by the White Helmets, bearing in mind that there is a UK government draft document that states very clearly that the UK Foreign Office, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch rely extensively on reports from the White Helmets to produce their own reports. So, I mean, this opens a massive can of worms, but what is a very important point to make here is Dalati only released this information after a report in The Intercept by James Harkin, who's also a reporter for The Guardian, which actually stated that there was no sarin and that the event was staged, or this part of the event was staged. So it's very convenient that Dalati announces his findings, which it took him 6 months to find, not inside Syria, but in Beirut, immediately after Harkin had already basically blown it apart.
Yes. Now, I want to just mention, just to highlight the fact that, of course, he has made this statement. Nobody in the mainstream press in Britain is covering this at all. We've got we've got articles in Sputnik. I believe RT's covering it as well. But nobody in the British mainstream press here, they all seem to be gathering together to protect the BBC, perhaps. But we should also just remember that Robert Stewart, who's been highlighting the Saving Syria's Children documentary for Panorama, was pushing this out. He was reminding us that Dalati was also a researcher on the BBC Saving Syria's Children documentary, which contained fabricated sequences, and during the filming of which the BBC Panorama team embedded with then ISIS partners Ahrar al-Sham and directly cooperated with ISIS. And he has the photographic evidence to show that. So, you know, but I really want to push this point, Vanessa, that the British mainstream media not criticising the BBC for Saving Syria's Children, apparently not criticising the BBC for this particular comment from their journalist, because, of course, they're implicated in this as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, if we remember, even after the OPCW interim report in July 2018, the BBC initially ran with the headline that the OPCW had found chlorine in Douma, or chlorine had been used in Douma, which again was misrepresenting the OPCW report. In fact, they retracted that headline on their program shortly afterwards when it was picked up on, because the OPCW report has not found that chlorine as a chemical weapon was used. It has found chlorinated elements in Douma. So it has not confirmed any use of the weaponization of chlorine in this attack. Yet the BBC again tried to mislead people back in July 2018. So, you know, this shows the consistency of our media, particularly in the UK, particularly The Guardian, particularly Channel 4 and the BBC, to run with narratives produced by the White Helmet that have been proven by independent media and by Russian media time and time again to be staging events. And yet our media is using it to manufacture consent for an escalation and military intervention by our government. This has to raise the question of a public inquiry and an investigation into the entire war effort in Syria since 2011. On what basis have we spent 2.7 billion in humanitarian aid inside Syria?
Very good questions and a very good suggestion. OK, well, look, thank you very much, Vanessa. We'll leave this there, but we're going to do more on the BBC here, I think.
Well, let's follow through, because really what we're talking about is the integrity of the BBC. And Mike and I this morning were just commenting on the fact that when we look at BBC headlines and articles, we're seeing more and more cartoons brought in. The language is highly patronising. We picked up on this report, Why EU Leaders Are Not Ready to Budge on Brexit, by Katia Adler. And what is this about? Well, a big part of it is to get on to BBC fact checking, where there's a little cartoon. It's addressing the public as if their average age is about 4, I should think. And we're to believe that what's being reported here is accurate on how the EU sees things. So there's nothing of substance. There's nothing about sovereignty for UK or the constitution. This is just a mishmash of a report from the EU by this lady. So who is she? Well, we just thought we'd just go having a look at what we could find. So LinkedIn is pretty good here. It says some interesting things. I'm the BBC's award-winning Europe editor and BBC presenter with over 20 years broadcasting experience. Worked on Hard Talk, BBC World TV, produced investigative documentaries. So we've got the much praised After Brexit, The Battle for Europe, Spain Stolen Babies. And on it goes. In 2018, I was named PSA's Broadcaster of the Year for my Brexit coverage. But there's no substance here. And if we just bring in this little bit, which is also on LinkedIn, I found this very interesting. From 1996 to present, 23 years, she's been a moderator, chair and host, including for Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Intelligence Squared, GE, NBC, the German Marshall Fund. These are very, very interesting organisations that she seems to be able to work with quite freely. CERN, London's Frontline Club, the European Space Agency and Commission. This is a lady deeply embedded in a lot of the globalist infrastructure. So I find myself wondering what her real allegiances are. And if you want to find out a bit more, then you end up very obscure places like Married Biography, which is basically talking about wealthy, famous people. So it basically says she's a journalist. It says that she's worth a lot of money, $2.5 million, although I've seen a lot more than that. Nationality is British. It even gives her weight and height. But this is the very interesting bit here. It says that Adler was born on the 9th of March 1972, and she grew up in an English-speaking German household in London. I found that fascinating because I wondered what it meant. Does that mean her parents are German? But she doesn't. There's nothing you can find about her parents. We're not to know anything about those. An English-speaking German household. Alex, can I just ask for your interpretation on that one before I move on through?
Well, Brian, you've asked me, so I'm going to have to be frank, even though I might get into trouble for the insinuations of this, but the Jewish Katia Adler, Michal is certainly a Jewish woman's Old Testament name. It was a wife of King Saul. And Adler, meaning eagle, is certainly a widespread German surname, but tends to be used by German Jews. And also it tends to be German Jews who, when moving to Britain, talk of themselves as a German family in Britain rather than saying Jewish or British. Please don't understand me to be implying anything more than just the facts there, as you did ask me.
Yes, OK. So my point is it's fascinating when we start to look at people and their connections. Now, this one was interesting because she gets a mention here in this report on women who shape Brussels. And it says 20 powerhouses driving debates and influencing policy. So does this mean that this lady, according to Politico, actually is helping influence European policy? Isn't her job independent reporting? Well, to be fair to her, that's part of that article where you can click on these very powerful ladies and see some details. And obviously she comes up there. But if you get into this article, it's the Telegraph, which is actually saying that if you want good independent reporting, then she's a good source to go to. So it's difficult to know why you'd be so cagey about your background, because that's the way I read it. Otherwise, you'd be quite proud of your background. But anyway, if we go on, the style of reporting comes back to the cartoon. So this is a Twitter page, Brexit cast. What does it say? Roses are red, violets are blue. Theresa May is beaten again in the Commons. This is for what? Children?
Yeah.
I don't know. But this is where it gets interesting, because here she's actually encouraging you to go and look at politico.eu. So the organisation that's given her award, effectively, or commented on her status, she says, if you want to find out about the Yellow Jackets, go and have a look. Well, when you do go and have a look, there's some pretty unpleasant stuff here, because here's a guide to the different species and subspecies of yellow jackets. So we've got people now being called subspecies. There's something deeply offensive about this. And if you look at how they rate people, if you're a pensioner who was taking part in the protests in France, you're titled as a raging pensioner. You're a conspiracy theorist if you're standing up against the EU or other matters. The self-adoring hard-right urban guerrilla, or the self-adoring hard-left urban guerrilla. So effectively, according to the BBC here, who's promoting this, challenge the state and you're a subspecies. Subhuman would that be, Alex, do you think?
Well, sorry to the link to the previous thing I said, but Untermensch is the term. And lest anyone think I'm pinning blame on Germans or Jews here, the idea of being subhuman and of being a Herrenvolk, a race of gentlemen, often mistranslated master race, comes from interwar British eugenicists. And in fact, from Victorian and earlier Malthusian eugenicists before it was ever injected into Central Europe. I should also mention that I've just come off a French TGV this morning, and Vanessa will, of course, be able to say more about the mood in France. But what I noticed about the French press people were reading on the train is that the headline this morning was zero tolerance policy against les casseurs, the wreckers or the agents provocateurs. The French actually don't call them agents provocateurs much. They call them casseurs. So the mainstream press view is these people are wreckers and we're going to move in and crack skulls now, as if they haven't cracked enough already.
OK, well, Alex, there's obviously a lot more to deduce from this, but I find it very, very strange. And if we're really challenging the BBC for independent reporting, they can't get it right in Syria. They don't want to report on what's happening on the ground in France. And we haven't got time to get into it. Perhaps we'll do it another day. But if you follow her tweets through, one of the things that she's also showing is people responding to her tweets saying, why isn't the BBC getting in on the ground and reporting what the French people are really interested in? But she doesn't answer any of those concerns. So my point is, you know, this lady is reporting, but really, who is she and what are her allegiances? And are we actually getting a balanced picture? I'm not convinced.
Just before we move on, Brian, I just want to ask Vanessa briefly, is there any of that type of rhetoric appearing in the French press?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the French press, the French state are or have from the very beginning actually dehumanized the yellow vest or the gilet jaune. That is shown by the state sanctioning of the violence used against the gilet jaune. I mean, there is no accountability for the forces and for the private security firms that are being used to carry out these brutal acts. But we're seeing, of course, severe sentences being passed out, for example, against the boxer who dared to smack a few police back after they truncheoned a woman who'd already been knocked to the ground. He's received a 3-year sentence. You know, we're seeing there was, I believe, a baker who refused entry to an armed policeman into a shop. Again, he's being told he has to apologise to the police. So we're seeing a crackdown on any sort of pushback from the subspecies, as you're talking about, while the police are being able to carry out violent acts and mutilate civilians without any apparent accountability.
Okay, thank you for that, Vanessa. Now we're going to move on to Brexit, Alex, and well, Mark Rutte in the Netherlands, what's he got to say here? The ones who are going to be hurt by Brexit are the UK. They already have been hurt. It's a diminished country compared with 2 or 3 years ago. It's going to turn into a second-rate economy somewhere out in the Atlantic. It's no EU or USA. It's too small to stand on the world stage in its own right.
Mark Rutte, of course, is the Dutch Prime Minister, and he leads the Dutch Liberal Party, the VVD, although in British equivalents, it would be somewhere between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. It's a party of major business interests above anything, and notably more secular than most of the Dutch mainstream parties. Rutte is one of the few prime ministers in Europe who is of the liberal political family, in the classic political sense of liberal, that is. And really, I think he shocked the Dutch with this turn, because the comparison with the Dutch past, which was very much an Atlanticist country along the same lines as Britain, looking to have its own currency be appreciated for its own product and service exports. This was something the Netherlands achieved with a quarter of the population and perhaps a seventh or so of the surface area of Britain or even just of England. And now Rutte is completely turning against that heritage, not just of the Dutch nation he represents, but also of the major business owners who have put his party in office, and saying, no, actually, we were repudiating the Anglo-Dutch way of business almost, and turning entirely to a deeper continental model of massive scale and an internal sewn-up market with tariffs to protect us inside and out. So I think this has really woken the Dutch up to some of the thinking that he's giving. And of course, it's not natural language for a Dutch politician. And many have suggested it's him angling, in this case, in the Spanish newspaper of record, El País, angling for a place in the new European Commission, perhaps, which is due to be appointed after the parliament elections later this spring.
OK, well, thanks for that. Now, one of the things that we wanted to discuss here was sticking with Brexit, was this, the issue of statutory instruments. Now, statutory instruments, secondary legislation, which require to be presented to Parliament and to the members of the House of Commons to be given the opportunity to comment and review. And of course, they are effectively declarations by secretaries of state, which within the limitations placed on them by the primary legislation from which they derive. But what we've got here, Alex, is the Hansard Society presenting a website listing the statutory instruments and the progress that's being made with respect to statutory instruments for Brexit. And of course, many of these coming from the Withdrawal Act, which passed last year, which seems to have fallen off the media radar. Quite a number of them need to be. I think this says something along the lines of there needing to be 497 statutory instruments passed.
Yes, Mike, out of a total of, Her Majesty's government said there would be 800 or possibly up to 1,000 of these pieces of secondary legislation, which are part of the European Union's acquis communautaire, the single parcel of laws and regulations that must be maintained by all member states and everyone else within their penumbra. Out of the 800 to 1,000 of them, something south of 400, so 300 and something, have been laid before Parliament and just left for MPs to notice them or not for a couple of weeks at a time. And the other half or more, so 400 plus, have not. So you can see with the pie charts there, it's slightly over half haven't and slightly more than half have. But there are more worrying pie charts and bar graphs later down the page, so people can have a look at that. Interesting green and purple colour scheme there, by the way. But the point before anyone goes to sleep about statutory instruments is the whole point of this actually ties in quite nicely with what Vanessa was just saying about people being given ridiculous sentences and fines for resisting lawfully police brutality. And the connection between the two, of course, Mike, is that the French in the vanguard, but the continent as a whole, have invented this concept of droit administratif, administrative law, which is where the government doesn't let judges anywhere near a citizen's complaint against officials. And the government says, no, we have our own internal courts for that. If a policeman has wronged you, the government and the police will judge the policeman, and a court, in the nearest sense to a crown court that the continent has, in most cases will not be allowed anywhere near that kind of redress. And there is, and even in some common law jurisdictions, notably the states, there is an equivalent doctrine coming in with regard to police officers called a qualified immunity or a presumption thereof. And in the case of statutory instruments, well, this is the softer end, but no less insidious in the end of that idea of administrative law. It is the government can from time to time, as supposedly allowed by Parliament, if Parliament's awake to it, the government can continue to churn out its own administrative regulations. So the EU bodies do this, the EU member states, national governments do this, even common law countries, including Britain, do it for themselves. But the SI is the means by which the nitty-gritty of EU directives and regulations are, as it's called, transposed, so made into British law, which is the big bottleneck at the moment. The main thing I've taken out of this, Mike, is that MPs have been so caught up in the Brexit fandango that they haven't been bothering to read the papers.
Well, I mean, this has been a criticism of the whole statutory instrument secondary legislation system as a whole for many years, because in general, stuff just goes through without any investigation, debate or consideration by the House of Commons. And when we've got a particularly significant process going on, as we do here, then, of course, it becomes even more significant. Now, of course, who's not highlighting any of this? The media. But as we were pointing out on Wednesday, the Cairn Cross Review was published on Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning. This is the screen. So there we go. Cairn Cross Review, a sustainable future for journalism. Frances Cairn Cross, of course, a journalist for many years herself. But anyway, one of the key points that she was making, as we highlighted on Wednesday, was that it was going to be down to the social media platforms to make a judgment on what was real news and what was fake news or disinformation. You've wanted to highlight this here. This is from the United States. YouTube announces it will no longer recommend conspiracy videos, and the subheadline is YouTube will no longer recommend videos, quotes, claiming that the earth is flat or making blatantly false claims about historic events like 9/11.
Yes, and the weasel word they're using, Mike, and of course they always use the sensational cases in the headlines, but they'll use many more besides, such as UK column material, perhaps, or quite likely. The justification they're now bringing in is a standard that if things come close to breaching their community guidelines, YouTube will allow its algorithm to remove such content from its recommended queue, which of course is how people stumble upon new material and gravitate and educate themselves from one line to another, or by mental evolution, really. That's being stymied. It's part of what you described for a while of keeping people in their pig pens, in their little boxes within the internet and not expanding their mind. But the notion of something being close to, sailing close to the wind is the kind of idiom that's being thought of here. It gives all the discretion and, in fact, legal force to these anonymous bodies like Google. People can look up Gemma O'Doherty's channel. She has two identically named ones because of Google taking one of her YouTube channels down. But if people look at the more recently updated of Gemma O'Doherty's, that's O'Doherty, YouTube channel, the most recent one there describes how she had an unprecedented success by going down to Google Europe's headquarters in the Dublin Docklands all day the day before yesterday and saying, why have you removed my content? Well, the thinking was the same as this. You know, it looks a bit like dodgy content. So a faceless person has decided to. There's a lot more worthy content in that update. So people should go and look for that video and subscribe to O'Doherty. But it's the bane of our digital lives at the moment.
Absolutely. Well, look, Dame Frances Cairn Cross was on the media show on Radio 4 on Wednesday afternoon. If anybody wants to go back and listen to that, it's well worth the listen. And she was being, well, first of all, one of her colleagues on there, one of the other guests, a German, was saying, well, you know, it's not the fake news that's being presented by alternative media. These are his words, you understand, that we need to worry about. It's the fake news that's being presented by the mainstream media. And so there was some reasonable criticism of the mainstream media on the media show on Wednesday. But she was asked directly about this issue of who decides what is disinformation and what is fake news in the first place. And it was at that point that I have to say she came across as stumbling. She was unable to express herself clearly. And it was basically, social media platforms would make that decision in the first instance. So, Alex, this is quite an interesting situation that she clearly felt that she, well, by her response, she was clearly feeling under pressure when she was being challenged on this particular point. When we've got YouTube and Google and Facebook making decisions about what's real or not, well, they haven't done the research. I think we've lost Alex at the moment.
Well, I'll just add in there, it seems to me, Mike, that it always comes down to who is selected to do the job. So the government, of course, selects the people to come in and be the representative, and then who is going to be selected? Are you going to select somebody who's going to challenge the government and its desired policies, or are you going to bring in somebody who you think will be capable of towing the line?
Yeah.
So most of the regulation bodies, if you follow it through, they always say on the website they're independent. Of course, they're not, because they're appointed by government.
Well, I'll just come back to the point that I was making on Wednesday. She produced 9 recommendations at the end, Brian, but these recommendations very much echoed the sentiments expressed by Matthew Hancock, who was the Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport a year before when he announced her review in the first place. And we are seeing that some of the recommendations that she has made are already being implemented by the social media companies at the behest of the British government, because they started the process.
With people like Nick Clegg embedded in those very companies.
Well, absolutely.
And of course, David Cameron, we'll come back to her. I can't remember the lady's name, but she was president of Google Europe, I think, involved directly with his family affairs. So.
Yeah.
So there's no separation of powers, if we describe it in those terms.
Alex, you're back.
Yes, sorry for the interruption to the signal there. I would just add that in this very interesting video, which Gemma O'Doherty does together with the Irish constitutional expert Vincent Byrne, who's very clued up on how people are literally being thrown out of their houses unlawfully in Ireland, one of the points she makes at the very beginning of the video is that she knows that the head of Twitter Ireland, not the whole of Europe, but Twitter Ireland, is a lady called Sinead McSweeney, and her past job was chief spin doctor for An Garda Síochána, the Irish Republic's police, and before that, she was spin doctor or similar role for the police service of Northern Ireland. So we're getting some clue there as to the kinds of people and agendas that are being brought into the social media companies.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, now let's head over to the other side of the Atlantic and this tweet from the White House. This is from the White House press secretary. President Trump will sign the government funding bill, as he has stated before, he will also take another executive action, including a national emergency, to ensure that we stop the national security and humanitarian crisis at the border. This, is, of course, is the border with Mexico. And really what I wanted to highlight here, which is something which is not being discussed in the mainstream press at all, which is why he's doing this. Much of the focus of the discussion is on immigration, and that's where the mainstream media focus is. But what they're not talking about is the drugs problem. And Trump has made no secret of the fact that one of the reasons, in fact, the major reason why he wants to build this wall is to deal with the drugs problem. And this is why he's describing it as a national emergency. This is why he's discussing national security and so on. And just to reinforce this, here is an article from a week or so ago, from AZ Central. £254 fentanyl seizure sets record at Nogales border crossing. Now, just so that everybody knows where that is, it's in Arizona, on the border with Mexico. And what this article is saying is that customs officers stationed at the commercial border crossing at Nogales made the largest fentanyl seizure ever recorded at any port entry to the United States the day after President Donald Trump signed a bill putting an end to the longest government shutdown in history. So this is a couple of weeks ago. Here's the key quote from this article. Saturday's bust contained enough fentanyl to kill more than 115 million people. Right, so this has to be put understood in that kind of context, the scale of the problem of drugs coming over the Mexican border. There was enough in this one seizure to kill 115 million people. Now, this is not something which is new. It's been understood. This article from the New York Times is from 2016, from early 2016, before Trump became president. So, you know, fentanyl is becoming an increasing problem in the United States. It is a huge problem. That's just one example of one seizure. And you know, the last time we discussed this on this programme, somebody in the chat box said, well, if they build the wall and stop them taking it over land, they'll just fly it in. Well, of course, it's a lot easier to restrict flights across the border than it is, a border that size. It's a lot easier to manage that problem of flying the drugs in rather than taking them in over land. So very interesting. It has to be seen in that context, I believe. Yeah. Okay, now, if you like what we're doing and you'd like to support us, please do consider joining. And you can do that at ukcolumn.org/community. There are a number of membership levels if you would like to do that. And I'd just like to remind everybody as well, AV9.1 DVDs available on the UK Column website. Brian gave a presentation at that. Alex Thompson gave a presentation. Patrick Henningsen, Dr. Graham Downing and Ian R. Crane. Hugely interesting. Get your DVDs if you can.
And another reminder for February the 22nd, 7:30 in the evening, Buckfast Lee in Devon. There's going to be what I think will be an excellent talk on 5G and the health impacts of that.
Now, if we're talking about the state of the British economy after Brexit, well, perhaps we see that other forces continue to operate to break that economy down. So here's Forces Network website, could Royal Navy engine production for Type 26 relocate to France? And what they're saying is that the chairman of the Defence Select Committee is expressing concern that specialist work on the new Type 26 Royal Navy frigates could be hived off to France. Dr. Julian Lewis has written to the Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson, fearing that engine production would be taken away from GE Power and Rugby and given to a French firm in Nancy. He says Britain would lose the ability to build large engines for the Royal Navy as well as valuable defence contracts. And of course, it isn't just about engines for the Royal Navy. This is what Julian Lewis said. There'll be a loss of the work for highly skilled elements of our defence workforce in this country. It's far from clear that the work could be done to the same standard in Nancy. But this is a continuation of a trend which has been going on for quite a number of years now.
Well, we're seeing the country hollowed out, Mike. And is it incompetence in British industries that's caused the problem? Well, clearly it isn't, because it's too widespread. But everything is being shut down step by step by step. We're coming out of Brexit. That's the big lie from the Conservative Party. But of course, behind the scenes, we're seeing industry given away, or we're locked in with European industry so that we're not leaving the European Union. And this is an interesting one local to the UK column, because this factory, Barden's factory, is only a few hundred yards away from the UK column studio. Johnny Mercer pushing out one of his briefing notes to say that he's been, well, he's been begging, really. He's been meeting up with the bosses of Schaeffler, which is the owners of Barden's, really to beg them not to move their factory, because it was announced they were going to close down the factory. They were quoting Brexit as part of the problem. Johnny Mercer, I've said, has gone begging. Why do I say that? Well, look at his language. I'm delighted the work so many have done in asking Schaeffler to look again at the closure has given us a glimmer of hope. This is the best Britain's politicians can do. This is Plymouth, which used to be building ships, building warships, with a whole raft of industry around that production. The city ringed with factories, and those factories have been shut down one after another, including on one particular occasion. This was television production. The workforce in Plymouth were asked to train a Polish workforce. That occurred over several months. And once the Plymouth workers had completed the training of the Polish colleagues, the factory was moved to Poland. So we're seeing that at the moment, UK is being hollowed out. And what are our MPs doing? Well, apparently they're powerless to do anything, but they can go begging to the Germans, please don't shut your factory.
Let's move on to law, issues of law. And although this is a US story here, Alex, Tennessee bills would require courts to fully inform juries. It pretty much describes the situation that applies in any common law country and in the UK, as an example. because this is about the ability of juries to annul bad legislation.
Yes, Mike. I actually am in touch with some people in Tennessee who are at the sharp end of lobbying for this. One of them who says that back in 1995 he wrote and produced a documentary on jury nullification, which my friend says sowed the idea, which is now finally becoming a household phrase. There's a couple of other states, mostly with a Southern Christian heritage, but also states like Minnesota, where this awareness is growing. But it's just by way of saying it takes a generation of awareness raising, which is why we very much need the British Constitution Group and the New Chartist movement to continue with the campaigns and the grassroots to reawaken people to this English-speaking heritage of our common law. Why am I going on about something so arcane sounding as jury nullification? Well, let's hear what one of the founding fathers, John Jay, and in fact a writer of some of the best of the Federalist Papers, had to say about this. When the US Supreme Court had its first ever empaneled jury for a case, which was State of Georgia versus Brailsford, John Jay told the jury that it is presumed that juries are the best judges of facts. In other words, did he do it? And Jay says, on the other hand, presumable that the courts are the best judges of law. In other words, one tends to look to the honourable judge and clerk to tell you what the statute book says. But still, John Jay said to the jury, both objects, that's the facts and the law, are lawfully within your power of decision. This is what you get trashed for now. I mean, my father, back in the 80s, was already going into Crown Courts and saying juries are the judge of law and facts, and Crown Court judges were saying, absolute nonsense, shut up, Mr. Thompson. And in the States, people have been jailed, even standing across the street from the courthouse, by judges sending bench warrants out to an officer to cross the road to get them because it's such deadly information. What can it lead to in the end? Well, two heroes of mine now, Clive Ponting, who was the MOD civil servant who let the country know that the General Belgrano was sunk on a lie. And then later, Catherine Goon, a desk colleague of mine, who let the Independent know about the NSA spying on UN member states with regard to the Iraq war vote in 2003. Both of these successfully saw off the Director of Public Prosecutions by saying, I will get the jury to nullify. In Ponting's case, he actually had to go and stand in the stand and tell the jury, you have powers of nullification here in England. We gave it to the Americans in the first place. Catherine Goon's team didn't even have to take it that far. They just told GCHQ's lawyers and the CPS, if you take this to trial, we will call upon the jury to nullify. That's the power of this. It's the people saying, even if this is a lawful statute in some cases, it being unjustly used in this case.
And that is why they're working as hard as they can to remove juries from our judicial system.
Absolutely so, yes. Juries are being told that they only need to show up if there's a guilty plea and only for the main part of the hearing. And of course, Brian has personally witnessed, they're often told now, completely unlawfully, I need you to find this verdict for me, or think appropriately. There's a very English way of doing it. In France, of course, they have juries for show, but they write books for trainee judges on how to sit with the jury and tell them how to vote.
Yes. Okay, look, Alex, we're running out of time, so let's just briefly on this one, please. John Halley, legal system could traumatise girl abused by Christopher Daniel all over again. Now, this is from Scotland, and it's a pretty nasty paedophile case.
It has, and people can read the details if they're Times subscribers by going to the original version of this in the Times. But if you're not, you can find it now reproduced in Scottish legal news. And the point is not Scotland specific or even child sex abuse specific. The points being made here is the weasel sentence at the end of that. I think he's a part-time sheriff, i.e. part-time minor judge in Scotland. His last sentence gives the game away. He says, when lay people question sex abuse victims or alleged victims on video, which is international standard now to stop them being traumatized in court unnecessarily, we don't know what these plebs are asking them, and they could be re-traumatizing by not being professional and not being members of the guild as they ask the questions. So I think people can see that that's the main stitch up if there are inconvenient testimonies about to be made by children.
Okay, and just to end this little section, I wanted to bring Chris Long, who's the head of the Crown Prosecution Crown Prosecution Service of the East of England. And of course, he was talking about Prince Philip's recent car accident. He said the Crown Prosecution Service has carefully reviewed material submitted by police in relation to a traffic collision on the A149 on 17th January this year. We have decided it would not be in the public interest to prosecute. Now, Alex, what I found interesting about this is when you actually look at the Crown Prosecution Service guidelines on this, they say it's not the function of the Crown Prosecution Service to decide whether a person is guilty of a criminal offence, but to make fair, independent and objective assessments about whether it is appropriate to present charges for the criminal court to consider. The CPS assessment of any case is not in any sense a finding of or implication of any guilt or criminal conduct. It's not a finding of fact, which can only be made by a court, but rather an assessment of what might be possible to prove in a court. So in other words, it's a test of the evidence. But then they go on to say this, that if the CPS finds that a case passes the evidential test, it then assesses public interest. So the issue of Prince Philip not being prosecuted for having caused quite a serious car accident has passed the evidential test. There is clearly therefore enough evidence to have taken it to court if they had wished. They've now decided on the basis of public interest not to take this to court. But Alex, it seems to me that the public interest is to demonstrate that no one is above the law in this case, or in any case.
Yes, Mike, well, as briefly as I can, the fudge here is the classic English one of using sweet-sounding language, words like not appropriate. This is a deliberately fudged copy of French legal terms. A Frenchman of any education would understand what's going on here. In the original civil law thinking that's been Englished in this way, state prosecutor has used the principle of opportunity. In other words, is it opportune? Will it be embarrassing to prosecute? And has decided that for reasons of state, as the French original would put it, we're not going to go ahead. All continental prosecutors have this in their training. We're here to protect the state, they say openly in their material. It's one of our most treasured possessions for 100, especially in most of the continent, that we don't allow private prosecutions. And we can quash anything that will not that it will embarrass the state. The fudge in England is that we just have this phrase "public," which people take to mean us the people, but it isn't. It's the government.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the key thing. We're up for time. Alex and Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us. Vanessa, I don't know whether you'd like.
I think she's not there anymore.
Oh, she's gone.
Yeah.
Okay. Alex, thank you very much for joining us. Great to have you back, and we look forward to getting you back onto UK Column News in the future. We'll end there. Thank you to all our viewers and listeners, and we'll say once again, if you like what the UK Column is doing, please subscribe and or donate, because we can only do what we do with your financial help. And we will also say to you, we don't do what we do for sheer pleasure. We're trying to get information across. How can you use that information? Take what we give, check it, and then start to ask the questions of those BBC journalists. Why is the BBC now able to put out fake news? And ask questions of your MPs about what is really happening with Brexit without the exit. That's it for today. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.